Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Podcast. I'm Gary Brandley.
I'm Jenny Brentis.
And I'm Connor Orr.
Week 14, it was full of blowouts, and it was full of games that started as blowouts and then got really close and interesting. We had lots of winners. We had self-professed winners and their loser assistant coaches. We'll get to that a little bit later in the show. But we also have so many games where it's getting real as far as playoff implications go. And with that in mind, we're going to start with a trio of games here, two that happened in the late window, and then we're going to back up to a little bit of Browns-Ravens action. But we are starting in Tampa with the defending champions and the Buffalo Bills in what was certainly the game of the day at this point, and one where it looked like the Bills were just sort of left for dead by halftime, and then they scratch back into it. And I don't know, you know, starting on the Bucs side of it, I don't know what we take away as far as the Bucs go here, except the fact that they pile up another win, and you know, maybe they still have some issues in the secondary.
My takeaway is Breshad Perriman looks pretty good, so you could probably cut Antonio Brown now and quit pretending to keep him on the roster for no reason. But I just think that anybody who suggests that there's some sort of lingering issue here fails to realize that there probably is an absence of a truly perfect team in the NFL this year. Like, I do think that generally defenses have caught up to the point where any of the stuff that has been sort of world beating from an offensive perspective has been diminished slightly. And so Tampa is probably the closest thing, or close to the closest thing, as we have to a complete team. And it just means that they're very efficient and they're difficult to beat. And like the old Patriots teams that Tom Brady came from, they're not going to be like glittery and, you know, really beautiful about it. They're just going to do it. And I think that's what we're going to have to get accustomed to.
Yeah, the Bucs are still in the mix for the number one seed in the NFC, which is impressive for a defending Super Bowl champion. But the back to what you said, Gary, about the cornerback position, I think it's notable that in both of the late window games that resulted in a team coming back and pushing the game into overtime, both teams have an issue at the cornerback position. And so that opens the door in a game like that where, in this case, the Bills, or in the other case, the Bengals, are trying to get back into the game, and they're able to do that quickly because of the other team's lack of talent or depth or whatever at the cornerback position.
Yeah, and on top of that, you saw with Mike Edwards out, Richard Sherman was playing some snaps at safety there. Looked pretty rough on the Dawson Knox catch and run there that set up the Bills' final score. But yeah, I don't know. This Bucs team still looks like they are as good as anyone in the NFC. And I agree with you, Connor. I mean, there's no one's going to be perfect here. But this is a team that if they can consistently put themselves in those sort of like, you know, third to 4 yards or 6 yards type of situations, they're just going to keep moving the ball again and again. And we all forgot they had Breshad Perriman as well, who is fast. As far as the Bills go, at halftime of this game, it looked like it was going to be yet another performance by this defense where they just sort of got punched in the face repeatedly by a really good offense. And everyone points to the Bills' overall statistics, but a lot of that, you know, they got fat off of some really bad opponents early in the year. And, you know, we know what happened last Monday night. We know they couldn't tackle Jonathan Taylor. We know they gave up a lot of points to the Titans and let one slip away earlier this year. But the defense stepped up in the second half, and it's almost like, even though you're not going to, you know, if you're the Bills, you're not playing for moral victories here, this feels like something of a step forward for this defense, especially when you're lacking Tre'Davious White, who's not going to be back this year.
Yeah, that's a big loss for the defense, that whenever you lose a player of that caliber, it takes a little bit of time to adjust. And I think you're right, Gary, they showed signs in the second half of maybe turning the corner and figuring out how to operate without him a little bit better. The long Fournette touchdown run was just sort of a, okay, this is going to be another game just like the previous game when the Patriots won by almost exclusively running the ball. And then things got a little bit better in the second half. One thing I wanted to note is it seemed as though they took the talking point all week that why didn't the Bills have Josh Allen run the ball more? And then Josh Allen was their main runner this week. So it seemed like they took that a little bit to an extreme. But, I mean, it's a tough stretch here for the Bills. And they have the Patriots again in 2 weeks. And it's just they're not in the best position. And then so to have to come off that Patriots loss on a short week and go play the defending Super Bowl champions is just a really brutal stretch here for them.
It is. And it's one of those things where I think if you didn't have that second half comeback, you could almost like not kiss the season goodbye. But, you know, if you got blown out, I think that that would be a sign that the team has kind of resigned itself to its current reality. But I think the fact that they at least came back and they showed some life there bodes well, because that first half just looked like a massive hangover from that game. And I think that there was such a potential psychologically for just for you just be tamped down after a primetime loss like that, then on short rest, then to have to go on the road and play the Buccaneers. That's a lot of stress to put on any team, regardless of, you know, a team, a defense trying to figure out their best player, a team without still an efficient running game. And getting Josh Allen involved is a good thing. It's what they did to get him, to help him develop in the first place, right? They wanted to establish him as a runner so they could, almost like the Panthers did with Cam Newton, spread everybody out, you know, force them to decide between spying on Josh Allen or putting an extra guy out there. And he got some easy completions, got the ball rolling early. I think they stopped doing that a little. And so reestablishing Josh Allen as a rusher, I think, only serves to benefit him down the road if the hits don't pile up.
I was going to say the unfortunate thing is he tweaked his ankle in this game.
Yes.
Although certainly he still looked like when he needed to move. And look, anyone who's had an ankle injury, it's sometimes it's not as problematic to just sort of run as it is to stop and cut and stuff like that. But, you know, he moved all right. And look, they were inches away from a go-ahead touchdown when he was on the sideline there. They also, I don't know, that Carlton Davis play on Stephon Diggs, that is pass interference 99 out of 100 times in the current NFL, and even worse, like that's a catchable ball. We see a lot of like bailout calls on that. You know, receiver wins and ball is there and gets dragged down, and that's a tough time to bury the flag in your pocket. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe there's a home field advantage thing to be called upon there.
Home field advantage, Brady, all of the usual conspiracy theories. I mean, that definitely should have been called. And then maybe we're talking about how the Bills found a way to win and are, you know, looking, you know, good down the stretch here, and maybe they're figuring things out, and maybe they're the team that we thought they were early in the season, but they don't get the call. And now we're talking about where they go from here, how they kind of get over two disappointing back-to-back losses. As you mentioned, Josh Allen's a little bit banged up. I mean, he really did everything he could to put the team on his back and win the game. So to have to leave and go home with another loss is certainly a disappointing outcome.
Yeah, it's. I'm glad you said conspiracy theory, because I did a Bills fan story leading up to Monday night. And so I ended up following a lot of Bills fans on Twitter to get in touch with them, to talk to them about their fears, hopes, anxieties about the Patriots game, and just never unfollowed them. They seem like nice enough people, but there are like grainy end zone angles of that pass interference play being passed around like the Zapruder film right now. And it's just like, they're just like, that's, and you nailed it, Jenny. It's like Tom Brady, like, you know, just the NFL wants us to leave Buffalo, and this is the clearest indication of, and I love it. But, and I'm also very sad for them. I think it's a fun group of people, but I enjoy it very thoroughly.
Well, the good news for those Bills fan is Buffalo's sitting at 7-6. You can't count wins you don't have yet, and this is a team that lost to the Jaguars, who, again, we're going to talk about a little later in the show. But they host the Panthers, the Jets, and the Falcons down the stretch here. Weird weather can sometimes equalize games here, but you figure there's a good chance, even if they lose the Patriots rematch, they get to 10 wins, they get into the postseason, and then we'll see what happens when they're in the tournament. But yeah, it's you know, it's a letdown, but you just saw signs of life, which is kind of what you needed by halftime of this game for the Bills.
Gary, you're one of two people in my life who have ever heard of consistently refer to the NFL playoffs as the tournament. So it's just a very interesting thing. The other former Giants general manager, Jerry Reese. So I guess you're in good company there.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That could have been much worse.
Just kidding. The devil. No.
49ers, Bengals.
All right. The other thriller from the late afternoon window was obviously the 49ers and Bengals going back and forth. We'll start with the 49ers side of it. I mean, this is a team that, like, they just, it seems like they're not quite popping. It's something is going just a little bit wrong on one side of the ball, one week or another, or they just end up piling up a bunch of weird turnovers and losing the games. But this, at least offensively, I mean, this is what they're supposed to be as far as a passing game goes. I mean, this was a whole lot of like George Kittle and Brandon Ayuk just making play after play with the ball in their hands.
Yeah, and Brandon Ayuk scores the game-winning touchdown, which I'm surprised that needed to go to replay, by the way. It seemed like a clear touchdown in real time. But in any event, that was a big step for Brandon Ayuk. It's been no secret that it's been a bumpy season for the former first-round pick. There were, you know, reports that he and Shanahan kind of had this come to Jesus moment or back and forth or whatever meeting they had. He wasn't in the mix early. There was clear disappointment from the organization in him. So for him to have that game-winning score indicates that maybe things have turned around for him. Certainly he's been playing better in recent weeks and makes the game-winning play in this situation. Of course, no one bigger to the 49ers offense than George Kittle, but Brandon Ayuk is showing signs that he could be the kind of additional weapon that they thought he might be.
Good game, too, for Juwan Jennings, too, getting in the mix a little bit. And I just think, I mean, I wrote this during the week, but George Kittle, to me, is, you know, when we have, a broader understanding, or we're able to, if we're able to ever find like a common metric for offensive line play or blocking capabilities, like I think George Kittle is in the MVP conversation. Like if you look at the tide and the way that that team completely transformed when he came back to San Francisco, came back from injury and started being able to, like, you know, do these double team blocks with Trent Williams and, you know, kind of make himself involved in the running game, and the way that he diversifies that whole offense, they're a different team. They're a, you know, possibly like conference championship winning caliber team. And he is just the guy that changes all that. And he's been fantastic.
On the other side of this, I got to say, I thought Joe Burrow was spectacular in this game, because this is the issue when you play the 49ers and you keep giving it away in the first half. And Darius Phillips, their return specialist, muffed two punts and ended up giving away basically 10 points to the 49ers in the first half. When you play the 49ers from behind, not only do you have to deal with that sort of outside zone stuff and then the play action off of it, but you have to deal with that pass rush basically being able to pin their ears back. And they were getting to Joe Burrow. They were pressuring him constantly, and Burrow was still delivering throw after throw here to get the Bengals back into it. And especially when we got to the Bengals end up sort of short-circuiting a little bit. It got down under 10 minutes. They're still down two touchdowns. And Burrow put together two touchdown drives to bring it back in it. And I thought he was tremendous all day, but especially late.
Yeah, good. Like, I mean, it's everything that you thought going in, right? I mean, there's good downfield accuracy, but and all that kind of stuff. But it's that ability to sort of conjure these late drives out of nowhere that I think separates, you know, mediocre to medium range to really good quarterbacks. And especially if you're in a situation where, you know, if you're Burrow and sort of the bread and butter of that offense sometimes is that short range passing game where you can get your blocking receivers involved and everything. When that's not there, you know, your ability to hit Jamar Chase, you know, your ability to stretch the field like he's able to do, just makes them that sort of good plus offense, which I think is going to be good enough to make the playoffs and possibly good enough to like scare some other teams that you're going to face in there in the tournament, as Gary might call it.
And, you know, Gary, I think your point about being down against the 49ers is a really good one, because I noticed what? No, I looked up the play-by-play to get the exact time. 9:29 left in the fourth is when they had the 4th and 5 at the San Francisco 17. So you're down 2 scores at that point. You could go a lot of different directions. You could kick a field goal, but they decide to go for the touchdown because they know when the 49ers get the ball back, they can drain a lot of time off the clock. Now, maybe you'd go for a touchdown anyway, regardless of who the opponent is, but I think especially in that circumstance, even though you have almost 2/3 of the fourth quarter left, you know that you have to get a touchdown because they can drain so much time off the clock. And the result of that, going for it on the 4th and 5, is that tremendous play by Burrow. And you see Ja'Marr Chase kind of figure out a way to get open and keep his toes inbound against the end line. And Burrow's under pressure and he scampers out and he makes the touchdown pass. I mean, that was an incredible display. So the Bengals, the AFC North is kind of entirely wide open. Who knows how things are going to sort out. Whoever ends up atop the division, things are very bright in Cincinnati, which is not what you would have said going into this season.
It's, this one's going to stick in their craw just because it's like, you lose the turnover battle 2-0 on 2 special teams fumbles, and you're still right there in overtime. It's a game they should have won. They had the weird game last week against the Chargers at home where everyone was just sort of turning it over nonstop. But this is one where, you know, 2 special teams mistakes ends up just sort of doing them in when it's all said and done. But you're right, Jenny. This AFC North race is just completely bonkers right now, and we're going to get to the other half of it right now.
Browns Ravens.
So here we go, Connor. The Browns are back. It is happening. They are going on their run. This is gonna happen. I am sure of it. The Browns are going to win this division. But this was one where they're coming off their bye week. We know this is a team that is, you know, it's a cold weather team. They are, you know, if you're speaking in general terms, they are built for cold weather, sloppy football. They are really good in the trenches. They want to win with defense and run game and complementary quarterback play. And that's what they got in this game. And yes, it helps when Lamar Jackson is not in the lineup. And maybe it wasn't a beautiful ending to this game as far as letting the Ravens back into it. But stylistically, this is what the Browns are supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and like a healthier looking Baker Mayfield than we've seen. Like that pass to Jarvis Landry, like haven't been able to see him sort of get out of the pocket and like put that whole like upper body, like that full torque on a ball in a long time. Like it seemed like a lot of times he was pulling up or, you know, everything was kind of softer coming out of his arms, but there was a lot of zip in those passes today. And I don't know, I think that's what you need, right? You need Baker plus, and I think that that's what they got, and just enough. Plus, you know, if every starting quarterback that they play from here until the end of the season gets injured, I think that's also a solid part of the strategy. That's a game plan that I could stick to.
Do you think they started eating beef in Cleveland, Connor? I mean, maybe this is where things got a little bit tripped up here. You know, we got food poisoning in the AFC South, and then maybe the beef was actually a different team because the Browns are hot right now, just saying.
There's a good chance that my Oracle powers, just like any of the other gifts that I theoretically inherited genetically, are just deployed in a scattershot way because I don't have any of the organizational skills to make them work. So there's a good chance that I'm getting all the information, but just not properly disseminating it back. Also on the show a few weeks ago, I renounced my Browns Super Bowl pick. So it would make sense that they start rolling here. So I got to figure out a way to rationalize that to all my psychic Patreon subscribers who are quite upset.
So as far as the Ravens are concerned, Lamar Jackson, we'll see what happens with the ankle. You know, obviously you want him in the lineup, but how effective is he going to be if the ankle is at 85% or whatever hypothetical number you want to throw out at this point, because it's just fun to do. Tyler Huntley was, you know, he did a nice job in this game in relief, and obviously he brought the Ravens back into it. But this was actually the first time in more than a month, you had to go back to week 9 for the last time the Ravens scored 20 points in a game, which is just incredible because of the way we think of this offense and the way they started the season. They have not been doing anything offensively, and we know they have, you know, that Wink Martindale defense is still good, but we know they have some flaws on the back end, and obviously everyone's just attacking the crap out of Anthony Averett every time they play the Ravens at this point. But it's a really flawed team right now. And if Lamar Jackson is out or not as Lamar Jackson-y as he should be, I don't really know if they've stacked enough wins at 8-5 at this point to get to the playoffs. I think they're very much on the brink right now.
Yeah, it's been a really weird season for the Ravens. Obviously, Lamar Jackson missed a game earlier this year with an illness. Now he has the ankle injury. So we're not seeing the Ravens totally at full strength because we're seeing a lot more of Tyler Huntley than we ever expected this year. One part of this game I think that will be discussed a lot this week is what do you do when your team scores a touchdown and is down 9? Do you go for the 2-point conversion at that point or do you kick the extra point? Now, Harbaugh, after the game, made it seem like it was a no-brainer decision because you go for 2 and then you know at that point what you need to do for the remainder of the game. You know you're going to need at least 1 2-point conversion. So do you then, if you don't get it, you have to score twice more, or if you get it, you have to score once more. The flip side to that argument, though, is you can get within 1 score, and then when your team ultimately, if you score another touchdown and then you're going for the 2-point conversion, like there's a lot of momentum. The team knows that you can win the game with this play or force it to overtime. So I just feel like it's a different dynamic. And I feel like when you wait to go for the 2-point conversion for the second score, you almost have a better chance of getting it just because of momentum and feelings and good vibes and whatever, all those other intangible factors that coaches say they sometimes take into account.
Yeah, Jenny, I mean, and as you know, I mean, the Ravens are one of the more kind of analytically sound teams in the NFL. And, you know, I'm sure this was part of their protocol, but you're right. I mean, I would wonder at what point, you know, especially a team where, you know, he balances that so often, at least from a public facing role where he's going with the numbers, but then there's always that, well, my players wanted to do this, or I saw the look in Lamar's face, you know, a couple times he's used that as a reason for going for it on fourth down in really high risk situations. So I am surprised that, you know, he's kind of stuck to the kind of the, what would be the common analytical ask of you in that moment and not necessarily what would be more related to kind of how your players are going at that moment or vibing at that moment.
So if we are going to schedule watch right now, the Ravens get 3 home games, but one's against the Packers, one's against the Rams, one's against the Steelers. Steelers obviously beat them earlier this year. They also have to go to Cincinnati. And right now the Ravens are 1-3 within the division, which means, you know, the Steelers obviously with a tie have kind of a weird record. You probably wouldn't end up in a tie with them, but they need to beat the Bengals to have a chance to beat them in a tiebreaker scenario. And they might end up trailing the Browns when it's all said and done, because if you're Cleveland and, you know, their remaining schedule here is they host the Raiders next week, then they go to Green Bay, then they host the Steelers. If they win 2 of those 3 games, they could be set up for a AFC North title game at home against the Bengals in week 18. And that's what's going to happen. And then they're going to win it. And that's, sorry to spoil it for everyone.
This is Connor's turn to take a victory lap. At least according to Gary's prognostication.
It all that, you know, this just all makes me feel very uneasy. I'm not going to lie. It just, you know, we'll just see how it goes. Sometimes you need to let the cosmos reveal itself.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just not sure. I'm not sure I'm ready to say the Browns will win the division.
It, you know what it was for me? I don't know this, and this is random. Like sometimes, you know, when you are, infinitely connected to the future and all unknowable information, you just sort of get pangs of feelings when you're watching games. And like, there's that play where Tyler Huntley picked up a first down, and it was like, it was almost like angels in the outfield where they had the ball keep like zipping and nobody could pick it up. Like there was like 9 people on a very gifted defense that just could not tackle the Ravens backup quarterback. And he was just like juking individual people, and it looked like the whole thing was in slow motion. And I was just like, I don't think this team is going to be able to make the playoffs. I don't know. Like something about it just hit me in that moment. And I was like, this doesn't look right to me.
I was waiting for the next gen stats on how far he actually ran on that play.
Yes.
Because I bet
Jenny
famously
slaughtered us with Jenny famously slaughtered us with next gen stats. If you're regular listeners on our Wednesday quiz show, and totally dominated us.
I mean, maybe I saw an opening to bring up my recent win, and I pounced on it. I mean, just saying.
Celebrate the good.
Titans, Jaguars.
So the Jaguars continue their season. They go out to Tennessee and lose 20-0 in this one. But the look, the story as of the entire weekend pretty much is more Urban Meyer stuff. And this time it came from a very unusual source, which is the league's in-house media arm, who reported all sorts of unhappiness with Meyer among players, Marvin Jones specifically, among staff who allegedly he at least implied were losers as compared to him, who is a winner at 2-11 at this point. But or I guess he was probably in like 2-10 or 2-9 when he said that. But this is just more smoke around what continues to be an utter disaster. Like, this could not possibly be going worse right now.
Yeah, and another day when Trevor Lawrence, he throws four interceptions, and you just wonder, what the heck is Urban Meyer actually doing to get the most out of Trevor Lawrence? But beyond that, he just seems like a guy that doesn't want to be in the NFL, that thought he could just walk in and that it would be easy and he wouldn't have to change his approach or rethink his approach or try anything new. He just could do the same thing he's always done, and very quickly realized he was out of his depth, which was elucidated by his post-game remark to Vic Fangio that every week is like playing Alabama. And he just, now he seems like a guy who just doesn't want to be here. I mean, his post-game press conference was really bizarre. You know, there was the question about the offensive line play being poor, and, you know, the reporter seemed very worked up about it. And Urban Meyer was just like, the reporter said something like, you know, they're paid too much to be playing this poorly. And Urban Meyer was just like, yeah. And then there was the part where he was saying anyone who's leaking information will be terminated immediately. And it's like, when you're at the point, this goes for any organization, when you're at the point when you care more about who is leaking the information than the fact that what is being leaked happened and is not good and is not being received well, then you're just really, you can't go on as a leader at that point anymore.
Yeah, I realized that the previous 4 years has kind of given us a different perspective on leaks and whistleblowers and a different take on it, I guess, from a leadership perspective. But like, most sane people would view that as, oh, I need to look at myself and see what I'm doing wrong, because it seems like an awful lot of people are upset with me. And instead it was like, no, I'm going to get to the bottom of this and just fire everybody. But that illustrates to me sort of the bottom line difference. Like, Urban Meyer, you know, I saw people sort of saying, oh, well, he's always been like this, but that doesn't mean it's a good thing. Like, Urban Meyer was like kind of allowed to operate with complete impunity at the college level, and to just treat his assistant coaches like complete shit all the time, and, you know, force them to work long hours and berate them when they weren't doing well. And it was like this, like, you know, Eastern European gymnastics coach vibe. And, you know, it was very uncomfortable. And like, you can't operate like that at the NFL level. And now that people know who you are, you can't, like, you know, you can't go to a small town and do whatever you want on a weekend and then control it and have it deleted from social media because you're the king of the world. It doesn't work that way anymore. But I think what really bothers me is, like, you know, to Jenny's point, like, it just looks like he's sleeping out there. And there are coaches, there are people in the NFL, and we know tons of them, who would literally saw off one of their arms to coach an NFL game, to be a head coach for one NFL game. There are coaches like Eric Bieniemy who can't get a job, you know, despite having a sterling resume. And then you have Urban Meyer, who's doing like a bad Andy Kaufman impression. Like, it's almost so, he's almost so disinterested that this has to be a comedic bit. Like, it's almost funny how sleepy and pathetic it all looks. And I can't imagine what he's providing to the organization. Like, if you're Shad Khan and you're looking at this every week, it's just like, what are we bringing to the table? Like, what is making this go in a positive direction? There can't be anything at this point. You've alienated Marvin Jones, who's one of the nicest people in the NFL.
Yeah, that's And as we go point counterpoint on the debate of what is going most wrong with Urban Meyer's regime so far, I agree with you, Connor. And the visuals are they're so discouraging. And it matters. It absolutely matters. And today we got probably what will be the play that will just sort of be shown on a loop, which was two Jaguars receivers, I believe it was LaVisca Chenault and Laquon Treadwell, running out into their routes and then immediately colliding with each other. And it looks like part of like a bad montage from like the worst, you know, unrealistic Disney movie you ever saw, where, oh, this team is so slapdash and, you know, but they'll get together and they'll fix it in the end. Like, no, those are professional football players who ran into each other. Those are world-class athletes who just ran into each other. Like, and that's like, awful.
Yeah, and Gary, I mean, sorry to cut you off. And by the way, you can say Angels in the Outfield twice in the same podcast. It's fine. We can reference the same movie. There are lots of really good bloopers in that movie. One of my favorites. As an aside, all-star cast there. Christopher Lloyd, Matthew McConaughey, Adrian Brody, Danny Glover. Just a really big-time movie. Joseph Gordon-Levitt. You know, Jenny, you and I covered the Jets. We covered a Brian Schottenheimer offense. I believe I got 2 years of a Brian Schottenheimer offense. I've never seen two receivers run into each other. I saw them play some pretty good games with some pretty bad to middle to bad quarterback play. So I don't know. I mean, I just think it's just so ridiculous to be blaming that on an assistant coach when, you know, and Darrell Bevell, same thing. I mean, you know, he's won a Super Bowl, you know, he's not a loser. So I don't know. This whole thing just seems sort of ridiculous to me.
Bears Packers.
All right. So the Sunday night game ended up being, it was pretty exciting. We had, we did the math just now. 31 points in the last 5 minutes of the first half, which added a little bit of a twist to what ended up being a comfortable Packers win over the Bears.
Yeah, I mean, going into this game, we expected a blowout, a not very exciting game, and it certainly ended up as a big Packers win, but Justin Fields kept things interesting in the first half. You know, he throws a pick six, but then right after that, throws another touchdown, and so that was a good sign of bouncing back from mistakes and continuing to learn and develop as a rookie quarterback. But then you get to the second half and it's pretty much all Green Bay and the game ended up pretty much where we thought it would end up.
Yeah, Matt Nagy teams in the second half this year have been very puzzling. Like, you know, and some coaches you sort of see shine in the adjustment period, right? When you go into halftime, you have a chance to look at things. And although I understand that halftime is not what the lay fan expects, where you're totally revamping the game plan and changing everything. I mean, you're kind of just checking in with everybody essentially, but some coaches come out of the second half with a lot better game plan, you know, and it just feels like the Bears, especially that third quarter just seems to be a spot that nails them down. But I would say one of Fields' better starts this year, but you know, is that going to be enough to move the needle? No. I mean, especially against the Packers team that, you know, we were talking about the Bucs and, you know, whether there's probably not a perfect team in the NFL, but the Buccaneers and the Packers to me both feels close to that perfect team as we can get this year.
Yeah. And there was, I don't know, there was something of a monkey's paw effect here to the Bears scoring these long touchdowns at the end of the first half. And it, I don't know, you just, when you score quickly and on long touchdowns like that, you just end up having to put your defense out there for more plays against Aaron Rodgers. And that's kind of, you know, whatever. Packers were out there for 34 minutes tonight. They run 62 plays, 440 yards. And it just, I don't know, once it kind of settled down after that rash of points in the first half, it just sort of fell into the familiar, I don't know, little bit here we do with these two teams.
The most embarrassing performance tonight, though, was from Chris Collinsworth. And we've talked about this before, but if you can't talk about off-the-field topics intelligently and with some modicum of thoughtfulness, then maybe just talk about the on-the-field stuff. Again, we had a bumbling performance dealing with the topic of Aaron Rodgers having misled the public, or the media rather, on the status of his vaccination, even though the team did know, comments from Collinsworth and Al Michaels that Aaron Rodgers likes to needle the media a little bit, and sort of a strange comment, a conversation in which Collinsworth said, "We've all been in a similar firestorm like that," and potentially implying that maybe Rodgers would appreciate Green Bay a little bit more through that process. It just didn't seem like anything that was sensical. I certainly haven't been in the middle of a firestorm because I misled people about my vaccination status, and I imagine that the majority of the viewers also haven't been. So I just didn't know where he was going with that point. And, you know, it continues to be frustrating that you have this national audience, you have the Sunday night game, and instead of preparing to discuss off the field topics in a, again, a thoughtful manner that would actually contribute something to the conversation, we constantly see them muddling their way through. And I think it really does a disservice to the intelligence of the viewers.
Yeah, legions of accountants and lawyers and, bartenders, waiters saying classic Rodgers. I remember when I completely misled my boss about my vaccination status, you know, totally, totally with you on that one, Chris. Also called Closing Time by Semisonic a country song, which was just a bad night overall from Chris without an H.
I would, I'll take the counterpoint. I will say, and we all host a podcast. Sometimes you just get caught in like a nonstop cycle of platitudes that mean absolutely nothing, and you just can't stop saying them. And I feel like that's what sort of unfolded tonight on the broadcast.
That's true. I mean, any live broadcast would be difficult and it would be challenging. Certainly, Shelby, our wonderful producer, can attest to the number of times that we have errors that we have to bleep out, and we're a recorded podcast, so we have that benefit. But if you are in this job and you're spending your week preparing for this game, you could at least prepare talking points ahead of time, right? You know you're going to touch on this subject. You don't have to say the thing that is the worst possible thing to say.
Do you think?
I consistently picture his note card, and it's just like, you know, like under the heading Antonio Brown, and there's like one column that says $1 million smile, and then another that says talk critically about issues of domestic violence, and he's just like $1 million smile column, or like Aaron Rodgers, fun to lie about vaccination status, or like, maybe we should just admit to people we're unvaccinated. He's like, column A, yes.
I just like to think of everyone in the pre-production meeting and Collinsworth kind of being like, you think Aaron Rodgers will come up tonight? You think we'll talk about him at all?
That vaccination immunization thing.
Classic goof.
Washington Cowboys.
So I like the Cowboys. I think the Cowboys are really good. I think they're going to be right there among the top contenders of the NFC. And the reason I like them is because they're showing this year they can win games in a variety of ways. And this was one of the weeks where Dak Prescott didn't play very well in this game, but they still won because they came out and they got a dominant defensive performance for the first, I don't know, at least 40 minutes or so. And it was, you know, just mounted enough of a lead that it was too late for them to actually cough it up in the end. So I thought this was, you know, as ugly as the end was, I thought this was a really encouraging game for Dallas once again, and not to mention one that sort of gives them pretty comfortable control of that division.
Yeah, totally. It was really necessary to ensure that they win the division because the schedule is kind of weird. There's a ton of NFC East games in the last few weeks of the season. So because of Washington's resurgence, it was possible they could still be in the mix. But this game essentially, as you said, Gary, gave the Cowboys the breathing room they needed, and they figured out ways to play. You know, incredible game-changing plays by Micah Parsons, who may break the rookie sack record. You have Randy Gregory making defensive plays. I mean, the identity of this team has really changed because of the life that Dan Quinn has breathed into the defense.
Yeah. And it was interesting. Like, even though Dak didn't play well, I do feel like almost like he's experimenting with some stuff. Like he looked different in the pocket, like almost like lighter. It looked like there was like some, you know, just some kind of interesting, like, I don't know, it's hard to describe, but sort of the way he was tinkering with some of the stuff, maybe his delivery, his footwork a little bit. I think that could lead to some interesting stuff down the road, maybe some better stuff as we move forward. But if you're Mike McCarthy, you got to win this game. If you guarantee victory at the beginning of the week and then both coaches get chap butts about it, you can't not win. And so I feel like it wasn't necessarily a statement win. It's not like one of those Tom Coughlin I'm all in moments, but it was kind of like, yeah, we're gonna win, and then you won. So I think that's like that's a good thing, because if the opposite happened, that you would look really bad.
I thought it wasn't quite a guarantee. Like, he was saying we're gonna win this game because we need to win this game. What do you guys think? Where do you fall? Do you think it was a guarantee?
Well, here's what I think. I think that I didn't know that there was essentially like a gentleman's agreement not to do this in the NFL. Like Ron Rivera's response in like kind of talking about how upset he was when this happened, I was like, okay, like, you know, the guarantee is at the crux of the NFL. This is Joe Namath. It's like part of the reason we're all here. And I think that more people should do it more often. But the problem is, maybe we in the media, and I'm lumping us all in together unfairly. All of us are great. We would never do anything like that. Maybe I would, but kind of just jump on a comment like out of context and blow it up unnecessarily. I think because we're all on the hunt for the guarantee, you know, the guarantee is a big thing. And so anytime you even hear something that's kind of like a guarantee, you make it into a guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
Guarantee adjacent, I think, is where it fell.
I remember this from the second Patriots Giants Super Bowl, and Tom Brady said something at a pep rally. It was also guarantee adjacent. It was something like, we're gonna come back here after we win or something. And I was assigned to ask Brady about it at the press conference when the Patriots arrived in Indianapolis, and I got a very cranky reply to my question about his comment. He said something along the lines of, it was a pep rally. So, you know, and in addition to having covered the Rex Ryan Jets, the guarantee is something I'm well versed in my years covering the NFL.
In those years, it almost lost all meaning in its entirety, the guarantee.
Yeah, definitely.
Chargers Giants.
All right. So before the break, we had, what was the chapped butts of Mike McCarthy and Ron Rivera out there. So We're going to transition to the hot seats of a couple of coaches.
Mm.
And we are actually starting with a guy. Joe Judge, reports are that he is going to be held on to. He's going to coach the Giants next season, and they're going to go forward with him. If the team is excited about it, it didn't shine through in this game. Now, granted, it's still, you know, no Daniel Jones. Mike Glennon is starting. They had a pretty comedically botched fake punt and all that stuff. But this game was, what, 37-7 at one point in the fourth quarter? This was a blowout against a Chargers team that, look, the Chargers have played down to competition sometimes, but boy, this was ugly.
Not a pretty game. You know, you had some kind of garbage time touchdowns from Saquon Barkley there, but yeah, just, you know, some of the things that sort of bother you about this, it's just the promise of Joe Judge. Regardless, like, you know, it's not going to be pretty. He said that during the season. He said, this is us, after like a 12-7 win that they had, or 13-9 or whatever it was earlier in the year. But in this game, it was sort of like bad tackling in space. And like, you know, and Austin Eckler is a shorter back, so he's going to be harder to find coming out of holes and stuff like that. But at the same, you know, to not be able to get guys down on like swing passes and to do those little things, that's the ultimate promise of Joe Judge. And if you're not delivering on that, fundamentals, tackling, toughness, then I feel like the whole kind of outer package is sort of flawed in general.
Yeah, the Giants are just totally lost right now. And there were reports a few weeks ago that Dave Gettleman is not expected back. But in those reports, it was kind of like, okay, well, who will be the general manager paired with Joe Judge? And I think with performances like this one, the Giants should also be evaluating Judge and if they want him back. Now, I know that's not what the Giants want, because they have been a coach turnstile over the last several years. And certainly that's not the perception of the organization. They would much rather be perceived as like the Steelers, having a small number of head coaches, but they've just gotten the hires wrong a lot recently. So I think for that reason, they probably don't want to make another move. But then you see a performance like this one, and it's just so lopsided, it's so ugly. It's a team that looks like it has absolutely no identity or direction. So it's like, well, where do you actually go from here?
Yeah, I mean, you stayed the whole week out there too. You're out west. You know, it's not like you were, you know, unprepared for the trip. You know, the organization kind of shelled out the additional money to make that happen and to make it look competitive. And it just, you know, I haven't seen anything out of this to legitimize another year. But it's interesting, Jenny, like I a lot of people just kind of blamed Dave Gettleman flat out for this. But the reason that Jason Garrett was moved on from was because the team was so talented, but not playing up to its capability. So it's like Dave Gettleman had a hand in that too. You know, he made them theoretically talented on paper, and the underperformance part of it isn't necessarily in his control. And so it's interesting to see how they kind of reason their way in and out of this. And to your other point, it's hard. I mean, good GMs aren't going to take that job. Like, you know, you're going to have to take someone who's friends with Joe Judge, with the understanding that you're going to fire that person too, once you get rid of Joe Judge. And that's really the only way you're going to be able to do that.
I will say, on the lighter side of things in this game, not for the Giants, but for the Chargers, Justin Herbert made just a couple of spectacular throws in this. There was one where he was rolling right, ended up throwing back downfield to the other side of the left hash. That, I don't know, I just, last week when the Giants lost to the Dolphins, Logan Ryan had made that sort of a snarky comment about, Logan Ryan would be the emergency quarterback and he could do it like Tua because he'd just be throwing short again and again and again and whatever. Justin Herbert in this game delivered this touchdown, up the middle of the field, up the seam, sort of scrambled, set his feet, fired it, I don't know, whatever it ended up being, 50-something yards, to Guyton against what was basically a cover four look. There were two safeties back there. They just didn't expect Justin Herbert to fire a laser on the run over their heads into the end zone. And they just sort of zoomed in on Logan Ryan after that touchdown, and he just sort of had this blank stare on his face, just like looking out into the middle distance, just kind of, I don't know, maybe reassessing his life and what he thinks of quarterbacks at this point. But Justin Herbert just sort of, I don't know, it felt like he just, you know, ate away at a little bit of Logan Ryan's soul with that throw.
Yeah, I mean, the Chargers have been a team that's a little bit hard to get a handle on this season because they've alternated wins and losses, and you're never quite sure what to expect of them on any given week. But throws like the ones Herbert made today make you think that they're a team, if they are in the tournament, Gary, can beat anybody because you have a quarterback that can do things like that. Now, the inconsistency is certainly a problem, so you'd have a hard time guaranteeing a victory for the Chargers, but they're a dangerous team because of the way Justin Herbert plays.
I do think that guaranteeing more victories would be a fun way for Brandon Staley to sort of get back into a regular mention on this podcast. He was a sort of a hot name at the beginning, faded out a little bit. And true. I just think, you know, if you want to get back on the pod there, Brandon, you know, just guarantee a few more victories.
By the way, I have to say, in the ensuing minutes, since our last conversation of guarantees, I Googled the Brady quote before Super Bowl 46, and it was, "We're going to give it our best, and hopefully we have a lot more people at our party next weekend." So the implication was they were going to be having a victory party. They did have a party that next weekend, but it was the kind of like drown your sorrows in Indianapolis before flying home type of party. So
been there.
Oh, man.
Falcons, Panthers.
All right, so these are two teams that are sort of just hanging out on the very fringes of the NFC playoff race. And, I mean, look, the Falcons won. They won 29-21. They're 6-7. They deserve, I don't know, whatever collective pat on the back you want to give them at this point. I think they're really bad. I think they're a really bad football team. I think they're one of the five worst football teams in the league. But they go into Carolina and win this game. And if you're the Panthers, this was, you know, coming off the bye week, coming off firing your offensive coordinator. It turns out they weren't really settled at quarterback. They hinted this might happen. Cam Newton came out of the game after a turnover. PJ Walker came on. Neither really seemed to be the answer, and they end up losing 29-21. Is it just seems like Matt Rhule is kind of mashing the keypad of ideas and just seeing what happens. And I would defend the job he's done holistically in that a team that does not have a starting caliber quarterback on the roster can't be expected to, you know, whatever, contend for the playoffs, and they're kind of hanging out there. But he seems to be doing everything in his power to make it worse the last couple of weeks, and I think that's what's alarming at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it just goes to show you, if you don't know who your quarterback is and you haven't made good decisions at the quarterback position, then how could you blame it on Joe Brady? How can you blame it on the offensive coordinator? And I think that's exactly what you're describing, Gary, is just kind of making all these movements, rash movements, hitting the keyboard type of movements. And really the issue is they haven't figured out the quarterback position. So whoever that falls on, I mean, general manager or if Rhule has input into it, but you bring in Sam Darnold and probably misjudge his ability to thrive somewhere else. The same issues we saw in New York came up again in Carolina. And then, you know, you make a midseason move for Cam Newton, you go back and forth, he's in the game, he's not in the game. It's just a very chaotic situation. So to the degree that that doesn't reflect on Matt Rhule's success with the team, it also shouldn't have reflected on the offensive coordinator's success in his position.
Matching buttons, Gary, describing my regular column writing process there. But this ended up being like one of the most nondescript games in NFL history. Like, it's just the Falcons are among the most anonymous teams in the NFL. And like, if they made the playoffs, I think there'd be a large swath of Americans who would have honestly forgotten that the Falcons existed. And so it would be a nice reminder that like, oh yeah, the team that lost in the big Super Bowl lead, you know, they're still here. And they've got another coach now. So this is all interesting things, you know. It'd be a nice chance for America to rediscover the Falcons.
Why was this game not in the lightning round, Gary?
Because we were on to coach backsides. Oh, and so Matt Rhule and the hot seat.
There you go. All right. I mean, I will say that the seat heaters has been one of the great inventions of the automobile industry in the last decade or so. So,
I mean, there you go. We could have gone that way, but I think the hot butts portion of the show is sponsored by Angels in the Outfield on VHS.
Chiefs, Raiders.
Well, now we're into the lightning-ish round, and we are starting with the Chiefs, who, I mean, they just smashed the Raiders in this one. And even though this has been a very lopsided, quote-unquote, rivalry, they played fairly close games recently. But this was this is a 48-9 Chiefs win. And I guess the big story is, I don't know, there was emblem stomping? Stepping? Dancing? Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what that was that the Raiders were doing before the game. Then after the game, the Chiefs did they played wheels on the bus on the PA as the Raiders were leaving, because the Raiders, if you don't know the backstory, the Raiders, when they upset the Chiefs last year, did victory laps in their bus around Arrowhead Stadium to celebrate. So yeah, just a lot of pettiness here, and that's delightful.
That was one of the best, like, few people I think can operate with such savagery as the stadium DJ, because I doubt that person falls under the purview of like the public relations department. Like, if you're the stadium DJ, you're probably a bit of a wild card, right? Like, yeah. I've never met a stadium DJ. I don't know what a stadium DJ, their day-to-day responsibilities are like, or how much they think about things going in, but to have the wheels on the bus queued up, I mean, the only thing that would have been more perfect, and obviously this is a different world, you know, John Gruden got let go before this moment, but to have John Gruden like scowling like that, you know, walking off the field when it was playing. But we didn't get that. We didn't get the truly perfect moment there, but we got something very close. Because now the Raiders are like plucky. Now they're fun, you know? So it's almost like, oh, that was kind of mean, you know, but because they're not jerks anymore. You know what I mean? Like all the jerks are gone. So it's a hard situation.
That was a classic Connor reaction. I mean, it was an interesting game, though, because the very first play of the game, the Chiefs defense comes up with a big play.
Yeah.
Continuing the unexpected turn that the defense would be the team lifting up the Chiefs over the last few weeks of the season. The offense also performed well, but the defense really was the spark that lit the fire today. And that and the logo stomping at midfield.
Don't stomp on the other team's logo if they've beaten you, like, what was it, 14 out of 17 coming to this one, and now it's 15 out of 18. Just leave the logo alone.
Who thinks that that's just a good idea?
That's what I'm like. Maybe I'm just one of those people that is like constantly waiting for the other shoe to drop and the bad thing to happen. Mm-hmm. But like, I would never taunt somebody like that because of the situation that you just described, where they would throw it back in your face and post game, they'd be talking about your actions really ticked them off and everyone knew what they needed to go out there to do. I mean, then you'd be like kicking yourself. Why did I do this? Why did I make this bad choice? It's just not for me. It's also probably why I was never a good athlete.
That's not that's not true. And anyone who wants to check the validity of that, there are state college swim records that are still owned by Jenny Rentis. I can verify that factually. And second thing is too, I like when teams who get the logo stomped on win big, because to me, that is the ultimate defense of some of your unspoken heroes who are your groundskeepers. So a nice homage to that, saying don't step on the grass that they worked very hard painting during the week and made look very presentable for the game on Sunday.
Very nice. Take care of the Wizards of Sod.
Lions, Broncos.
So I'll give you my Broncos stat right off the top here. They win this game 38-10. No winning streak for the Lions, but the Broncos are they're one of those teams that are right in it, 7-6 in the AFC wildcard race. But they are 6-0 when they force multiple turnovers in a game this year, and they got two in this game. And that's kind of I can't remember where I was talking about. One of the Denver stations had me on, and they were like, well, what does this team have to do to get 10 wins? And I was like, yeah, they got to get like 30 to 35 turnovers this year. Like, it's got to be a team that just gets multiple takeaways every week. That's stylistically how they're going to have to do it, and it's literally how they're having to do it this year.
Yeah, and that interception by Justin Simmons was really beautiful. I mean, he's one of the best defenders in the NFL, and he reached out for the ball, and I thought what was so impressive was that he like instinctively brought it into his chest so that when he tumbled to the ground, the ball didn't fall out, which is just, you know, it was just a gravity-defying type of play, but also to be that aware in the moment of where you need to put the ball was pretty impressive. Strong running game by the Broncos, and also the tribute that they had at the beginning of the game with only 10 men on the field to signify the loss of Demaryius Thomas was a really beautiful way to pay tribute.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think this Broncos team is going to hang tough. I mean, you know, they're 7-6 at this point. I still think my prediction is true that they might end up the season with the top five defense. I think that they're playing really well. I think the schedule breaks for them in a certain way here. And that's a team that I just wouldn't want to face in the playoffs. Like it's one of those weird, you know, almost, and again, like I hate to use this comp again, but it's like that poor man's Tampa Bay deal where they can run the ball and they're very capable of shutting you down. They have a good secondary. They have athletic linebackers, and it's just going to be a tough matchup for somebody, I think, in the first round of any game, of any play, of any tournament game.
Thank you.
Jets, Saints.
All right, so Saints go and beat the Jets 30-9. That's not a shocker, but I don't know. I feel like this, and even the loss to the Cowboys two Thursdays ago at this point, it's just kind of like you're seeing what Taysom Hill can do for you as your quarterback, and he's not for everyone, but I think when the alternatives were what they were for the Saints this season, it just, we've talked about this, Jenny. It just seemed to make so little sense that they wouldn't roll him out there and just have this kind of offense that has an actual identity to it, which is, you know, sort of this multidimensional run game.
Yeah, it was strange that it took them so long to go to Hill, and I know he had been working through an injury, but like Sean Payton has in many ways demonstrated his affection for Taysom Hill over the last few years, an affection that may not be shared by many others. And so the fact that he wasn't the immediate option when Jameis Winston went down was a head scratcher.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think he's, it's tough to say anything necessarily after you come off the four interception game and, you know, how everything kind of went the previous week before, but the Jets are at this point just kind of a nice team to face to get your groove back. And I think what's interesting here, and I doubt it's the way that Sean Payton ultimately goes with this, but I feel like it's easier to find a couple of Taysom Hills and put them on the same roster than to, what are you going to do at this point? There's no quarterback in the draft that is a first round caliber quarterback. It seems at this point, maybe Malik Willis, I don't know, but then, you know, if Russell Wilson, you're not getting Russell Wilson, you're not getting Aaron Rodgers, what's the option? Is to kind of do what the Ravens did and find a market inefficiency. And Taysom Hill, it seems like there are probably some other quarterbacks out there at some of these mid-majors that you could probably compile and sort of work something out with.
Seahawks, Texans.
All right, and we are wrapping the show on a game that was, it was close for a little bit. I mean, it was a three-point game at halftime. The Texans had a lead in the first quarter, which was somewhat surprising, but I don't know. I don't really know what to say about either of these teams other than the Seahawks are probably a lot closer to the Texans than they want to be at this point, and the Texans are just not really very good, though they do get their second crack at the Jaguars next week.
Boy, the end of this lightning round is pretty meager. Like every game that you listed, I was like, God, this has got to be the last one. And then when you mentioned Seahawks Texans, I was like, this game didn't even register on my radar. But a nice kind of I will say this, sort of a nice comeback game for Russell Wilson. Like he did some Russell Wilson stuff. There was some vintage pocket evasiveness when he was picking up some first downs. He looked more comfortable than he did in weeks prior. It's not going to bring you back to the playoffs, but it probably looks good for another team out there that's going to be vying for his services in the offseason.
Yeah, I feel like several weeks in a row, we've gotten to a final game that involved the Texans, and really it was just basically like the Texans also played this week. But yeah, you know, the Seahawks, they got to 5-8. So
it was like when Gary, when we got to the Jaguars part, was like the Jaguars continued their season tonight, which is like,
right.
For like when I was in college and you would cover, you know, like all your college sports teams, and there was like, you would wait for the note to come out from the athletic department and they would write their own game story and you would see what they wrote versus what you wrote. And like there, that was always like the first line of like, you know, our notoriously bad like volleyball team. It was like the volleyball team continued their season today with like a 49-1 loss to Penn State, you know? And it was like, we continued it. We kept going.
There was a epic story at my college newspaper where Penn State beat Ohio State. It was a tremendous game. This is the 2005 season, the year they went to the Orange Bowl. And, you know, it was a down to the wire game. They ranked number 8 in the nation afterward. And the headline was somehow Nittany Lions back in action. So that just brought that to mind, Connor.
Oh man. It's that's good. That's really good.
We can, by the way, I mean, we could add to the show a little Tie Cats, Blue Bombers.
Did anyone notice too, like, the deeper we got into the lightning round, the more uncertain the robot sounded, that like he even wanted to have us talk about these? Like, he was just like, Seahawks, Texans? Ugh. You know.
Oh man. By the way, the Blue Bombers won in overtime. Looks like it was pretty exciting. 33-25. Good finish there.
You know what? There's Great actually a tie in here, because the Blue Bombers play in a stadium that is constructed similarly to Seattle Stadium, even though the Seahawks-Texans game was in Houston. I just thought it would be worth adding. I've actually attended a Blue Bombers game, and the acoustics in the Blue Bombers stadium are epic for the CFL, similar to Seattle's home stadium. So
you did. I mean, you are also a CFL expert. I have to be very careful with with where I tread, especially if we do another trivia show at some point.
That's correct. That's correct.
Just one more Blue Bombers note, coached by CFL 2020 or 2021 Coach of the Year, Mike O'Shea. So just a big pop out there to Mike O'Shea. Nice. Doing some big things. Nicknamed O'Sh.
Going to become a CFL pod. I like the turn here.
Yeah. Graduate of Guelph University. Longtime Edmonton Eskimo. You know, I could just keep reading the wiki page if you guys are interested.
I wrote the wiki page. I'm not reading it to you.
One of my proudest bylines.
The MMQB NFL podcast is Jenny Vrentis, Connor Orr, and me, Gary Gramlin. We are produced by Shelby Royson. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody, and our senior podcast producer is Dan Bloom. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB, and Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts, and once you do, please leave a rating and review, because it really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.